It's 2:06. Thank you for listening to Political Rewind on Georgia Public Broadcasting. I'm Bradley George, filling in for Bill Nigut. Glad to be with you this afternoon. We're glad you're with us as well. And joining us this afternoon, Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Greg, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And also with us, Republican strategist Todd Rehm. Todd, good to see you.
Thank you. Always happy to be here.
Joining us for the very first time, Democratic State Representative Scott Holcomb. Scott, we're glad you're here as well. Thanks for stopping by.
Glad to be here.
And on the line with us from Macon is Chris Grant. He's a political science professor, or actually he's chair of the political science department at Mercer University. Chris, thanks for being here as well.
My pleasure.
And you can watch us if you're listening to us on the radio. That's great. But if you want to watch us having our discussion, you can do that on our Facebook page. Just search for GPB News on Facebook. Be sure to like us as well to keep up with updates from the GPB newsroom. We're also on Twitter. You can share your thoughts with us at PoliticsGPB. So we're going to get to the Supreme Court, and it's not the thing that I wanted to lead the show with because, Greg, we have some breaking news about that. Apparently, Justice Anthony Kennedy is going to retire.
Yes, and this gives President Trump another chance to fundamentally reshape the top of the judiciary. He already has appointed Neil Gorsuch to the bench, and we saw in the rulings this week how much of an impact Justice Gorsuch has already made on the judiciary, and I don't know if validating is the right word, but I'll use it, but validating the Republican strategy to hold the line against Merrick Garland. It shows just how fundamentally Gorsuch has changed with these 5-4 rulings, has changed some of these the scope of federal decisions already.
And speaking of 5-4 rulings, that's what we had today in the long-running water dispute between Georgia and Florida. And the court, Greg, is essentially sending this back to the special master that they appointed to sort this out.
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line of this ruling is that it extends the state's pricey, long-running legal skirmish with Florida. Georgia has already spent nearly $60 million since 2011 on litigation involving this water basin, and that sum is only going to grow much higher. Florida has spent even more than that, I should add. The Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, directed an expert judge that we call a special master to revisit key aspects of that case, which is a disappointing legal outcome, to say the least, for Georgia after it racked up several recent legal victories in this long-running, never-ending dispute.
And joining us now, Greg, is your AJC colleague, Tamar Holloman, from Washington. Tamar, how much exactly is this a disappointment for Georgia?
It's certainly a disappointment, like Greg mentioned. The state has racked up a string of victories in court over the last year or so. But at the same time, I think a lot of people were expecting kind of bracing for a ruling like this based on the they got from the justices during oral arguments in January. George came into those oral arguments super confident, but I saw justices like Stephen Breyer asking, wait, can't we do something to help Florida out here? So I think they were expecting it to a certain degree.
The other thing, too, is when you're reading this opinion, you get just a little bit of the sense that the court, or at least the majority on the court, is perturbed that they even had to take up this question anyway, that they would rather for the special master or for the states themselves to sort this out.
Yeah, exactly. And that's something that you saw in the special master's recommendation to their, he was saying to the governors, put this out among yourselves, the ruling that the court comes out with. And when it comes to the Supreme Court, these are lawyers, institutional experts, not water, natural resources experts. So I think they are frustrated that they have to kind of get into this spat between the states on something that they themselves are not experts on.
And Justice Clarence Thomas, writing in dissent, and he's a Georgia native, of course, kind of hit at that. I mean, he says this makes so little sense, in his words, to send the case back to the special master after he already sifted through more than 7 million pages of documents. He said, I'm quoting, giving Florida another bite at the apple will likely yield no additional evidence. In short, we have all the evidence we need to decide this case now. So that was pretty sharp words from the justice in his dissent.
So have we heard from Governor Deal on this?
Yeah, the governor says he's confident that Georgia's legal argument will still win the day. But, they're disappointed that millions of dollars more. Just last week, he shifted another $1 million from his emergency legal fund to help pay for more litigation. So they're all disappointed that even more money will be spent on this. And I had a chance to catch up with him yesterday to ask him about this case. And he really, it was a very candid moment. He lamented how close they were early in his tenure to reaching an out-of-court settlement with the two other states, and it just fell apart. And he said, you know, this really could have been done without all this legal expense.
I do think it's worth mentioning, though, even had the Supreme Court in Georgia's favor today, these water rights battles still would be continuing on forever. There are three other challenges working their way through federal court right now, having to do with some of these water basins in the Georgia area. So this was going to continue regardless. But this is just another, pun intended, another tributary in this fight.
So as we said, this is a 5-4 decision. Justice Stephen Breyer wrote the majority opinion. He was joined by Chief Justice John Roberts, by Justice Anthony Kennedy, by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and then Sonia Sotomayor. Clarence Thomas wrote the dissent. He was joined by Samuel Alito, Elena Kagan, and Neil Gorsuch. Tamar, what can we divine out of the makeup of the majority and the minority of this opinion?
Strange and rare. It really is. I mean, this was not an ideological decision, right? You have, you have Breyer and Sotomayor and Ginsburg, kind of the more liberal branch. You have Kennedy in the majority, kind of your more closest thing you have to a centrist, and you also have the Chief Justice. So it's kind of all over the place, and it goes to, you know, that's why people were kind of scared to make predictions going into this. It's less about ideology and more just about the details here. It wasn't even as much from kind of a regional perspective. It's not like you saw people from certain parts of the country going one way or another. So kind of an interesting and unique breakdown.
And now we've got kind of three different paths forward. We have the continuing legal battle, this case, and the others that Tamar mentioned. We have the prospect that a new round of governors next year could hammer out some sort of
agreement. That was going to be my next question, because we've got open governor seats in Florida and Georgia.
Yeah, and early in the term is, as the governor said yesterday, is the best time to do this, because later in the term it can be harder. Re-elections are near. A lot of states' interests become louder. And then, of course, there's the congressional path. And the governor warned against letting Congress hash this out for the states. He again urged his successor, whoever he or she may be, to work it out with the states rather than have to, you know, go through the gamut of Congress to hash it out.
Scott, I wrote a big story about this earlier in the year. Sorry to interrupt. But right now you have two members of the Alabama delegation who have taken very senior roles in the House and Senate Appropriations Committees. Those are the committees that must pass spending bills. And so they have a lot of power to kind of slip little provisions in there that people might not notice to kind of tip the balance, or at least that's what Georgia argues as they kind of freak out about it. So it is certainly something to watch very closely for Georgia.
All right. That's Tamar Holloman, Washington reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Tamar, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
And we've got lots more to talk about this afternoon on this Wednesday edition of Political Rewind, and we'll get to that right after this break.
You know, selling a car can be a hassle, but donating it is a whole different story. Let us take it off your hands or off your driveway and turn it into public radio and maybe even a tax deduction. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the host of Marketplace, and here is how to donate.
Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
Thanks for joining us for Political Rewind on GPB. I'm Bradley George, filling in for the still vacationing Bill Nigut. We haven't heard from him, so hopefully that means that he's enjoying his vacation and will come back tanned, rested, and ready next week. I'm here today with Greg Bluestein from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Republican strategist Todd Rehm, Democratic State Representative Scott Holcomb, and Mercer University Political Science Chairman Chris Grant. So, yesterday was primary day in South Carolina, in New York, and some other states. One of the big stories, probably the biggest story last night, was what happened in the congressional district in New York, in Queens, in the Bronx, where Representative Joe Crowley, he's the fourth ranking Democrat in the House, lost a primary challenge to 28-year-old Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Yeah, and this was a huge upset. Some political pundits predicted it, but most thought that Crowley would pull it off. And again, this is not just a high-ranking Democrat. This is someone who was looked at as a potential successor to House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. So this was the stunning upset by someone who had significantly less cash, but a lot of energy and momentum, who said that she wanted to upend the political status quo, and she was tired of sort of even Democrats who weren't as progressive as her platform was.
And she's somebody who, as you said, she didn't. I mean, Crowley's an incumbent. He had money. As I understand it, he kind of ran the Democratic political machine in Queens,
County.
New York. And here's a 28-year-old who had a lot of media savvy, who was able to really organize Democrats, organize new voters in this district. Scott Holcomb, what you look at this race? What do you see?
Well, I would caution not to extrapolate too much from a race up in New York and how that might impact things nationally or here in Georgia. But I think that it is a testament to how hard she worked. And she did not take anything for granted. She got out there and she went after voters that had long been ignored, people of youth, people of color, people who hadn't voted previously. And she executed her strategy really well. And to the point that was raised, she was incredibly and is very astute in terms of the media. And I, for one, welcome more engagement into the political process. There's a lot of people who are elected officials like I am, who do everything they can to not have any opposition in primaries in general. They want to just coast in and pay their qualifying fee and just sit in their seat all day long without having to defend it or earn it. I don't agree with that. I think this is very healthy for the process. It promotes an exchange of ideas. And I also think it's really incredible that she was a bartender last year,
right,
and now she's on track to her way to the U.S. Congress.
It's been said that she'll be the youngest woman elected to Congress.
Yeah, 28 years old.
Yeah. Chris Grant, the other side of this is the thing that it highlights by Joe Crowley losing is that the Democratic leadership in the House is incredibly old. You've got Steny Hoyer, you've got Nancy Pelosi, you've got James Clyburn, and that's been the team that's been in place for about the last 15 years or so. Crowley was seen as somebody could be Speaker of the House one day, could be Majority Leader, and now he's out of the picture. What does this say? Does it say anything about Democrats, congressional Democrats, especially in the House, and issues around seniority and age and leadership?
Oh, I definitely think it does. I think there's a lot of frustration amongst Democrats, especially younger Democrats, that the agenda that they would like to see the Democratic Party pursue is not there. They also want a leadership that seems like they are. Having a bunch of septuagenarians telling them what their interests are isn't necessarily what I talk to when I talk to my students about the sorts of politics they want. The one thing that I would throw a little bit of caution in here is that I think we are beginning to say, and some of the electorate is beginning to say, I will take anybody but those that have experience. And that may lead to some very interesting times in government.
Todd Ream, when you look at this race, what do you see?
I see the flip side, the flip side of the coin, that is the Dave Bratz victory a couple years
He's
ago.
He's the guy in Virginia against, who beat Eric Cantor.
Against Eric Cantor, who was at the time, I think he was majority whip or somewhere in a similar position in the party leadership.
He was the number two, yeah.
And there are two things that happen in Washington, D.C. The first is you become a 24/7 fundraiser if you're a member of Congress. And the second is, as you climb up the ladder of party leadership, if you're on the political side of it, you get much more interested and much more drawn into fundraising for your colleagues and doing appearances in their districts. And what I think happened probably in both of those cases, the Bratt versus Cantor case and the New York case, is that the office holder just didn't have a clue what was going on in his district.
Didn't live in the district, from what I've heard.
Yep,
right. Sent his kids to school in Washington.
Had not spent enough time in the district and didn't know what he was facing. I will also say that the two of the two best political ads I've seen this year— Hers was one of those two. It's a fantastic ad, very compelling.
And that ad went viral, and she was able to leverage her social media platform too in a way that we've seen just few candidates do. And another moment that kind of went viral was when Crowley refused to show up to a debate or a forum, and instead sent a surrogate, a young surrogate, to in his place. And she tweeted about how insulting that was for him to do that to her. And that went sort of viral as well and got a lot of attention. So this race was about a lot of things, but I think one of the biggest things it was about a progressive candidate who's running far to his left, who was able to capture the mood of the Democratic electorate in New York. We didn't see a direct parallel to that in Georgia in a way. I mean, Stacey Abrams and Stacey Evans both ran to the left of what their party's conventional approach has. But in lower level races, we did see candidates who were Democratic candidates who were once comfortable get real, you know, real close, tight challenges, and in some cases, lose to challengers who were more energetic and had much more stridently progressive platforms.
Scott. And that happened on the Republican side in a couple cases as well.
Yeah.
Scott, you want to chime in here?
Yeah, I was just going to hit what Todd said, which is that there were losses on both sides of the aisle. And that goes back to, I think, some of these threads that we've heard, which is when elected leaders get removed from the people that they represent, when they're distant, when they're not engaged, when they lose those relationships, is these types of outcomes are not surprising.
Chris Grant, I want to go back to something that Todd Rehm said. You know, when you're elected to Congress, you kind of have to become this fundraising machine. And I wonder, for someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's going to Washington, very young, very idealistic, does that kind of sap that energy a little bit?
Well, I think that what you find is that younger voters, folks that I talk to on a day-to-day basis, they want something different, and they're frustrated. I mean, I was talking with my class, my introduction to political science class today, 18-year-olds who say, we're the first generation that aren't expecting to have the earning potential that our parents had. And they're frustrated. They're not necessarily ideological. They're just frustrated. And when you have a leadership, everybody in the House leadership is over the age of 70. Our Senate leaders and our president are all over the 60s, 70s. They're very frustrated with it. And they want to see change. And they want visible change. And I think the traditional political structure isn't giving them what they want.
So that was that race. And the other big race last night over in South Carolina, the incumbent Republican governor, Henry McMaster, won his runoff. Of course, he was supported by President Trump. Trump held a rally for him there earlier this week. Greg, what sort of momentum does this give sort of the Trumpian reimagining of the Republican Party?
Yeah, I mean, it shows that his power, especially among conservative voters, where he's still tremendously popular, is almost supreme. I mean, Mike Pence and him kind of staged what I guess it would be called a rescue mission against a conservative challenger, because polls showed this race really tightening near the end. Instead, Mike Pence and Donald Trump visited. Pence visited, I think, Saturday. Trump visited Monday. Ended up speaking a lot about other issues more than Henry McMaster, but still attracted tens of thousands of people, a spillover crowd waiting for him outside. And McMaster was fueled to an easy victory over his challenger.
And I'm going to suggest that there's probably a Georgian's fingerprints on that. Nick Ayers, who is the Chris Riley to Mike Pence.
Yeah, the chief of staff.
Yes, chief of staff. Came up in Georgia and then to the Republican Governors Association. And with those connections, he was always going to have a personal interest in South Carolina. And I suspect, although I haven't spoken to Nick in a while, that he was probably urging them to get involved in that race.
So what I'm wondering is when and if President Trump is going to make an endorsement in the GOP governor's runoff here.
Yeah, I doubt he's going to weigh in on the runoff, but I suspect he will play a role once the nominee is decided. Because look, Stacey Abrams has no problem bringing down surrogates in a way that we haven't seen Democrats in the past do. When Barack Obama visited in 2014, both Michelle Nunn and Jason Carter did not appear with him. And even John Ossoff last year, I mean, he had no high-profile Democrats came down to stump for him, while President Trump came down to stump for Karen Handel. Stacey Abrams has no such problem with that. You've already seen Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, a range of other 2020 prospects, Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris.
Warren endorsed Abrams this week.
Just the other day, Hillary Clinton. So just about every 2020 Democratic presidential prospect has already endorsed her or is about to. So she's going to have a string of high-profile folks coming down here for her. I can imagine Donald Trump or other high-profile Republicans would be down here stumping for whoever the Republican nominee is.
And I think that has to do with the fact that Abrams has based her campaign on expanding the electorate, mm-hmm. bringing in a different set of voters than have traditionally voted, not cutting up the pie the way it's been cut up in the past, but literally to expand it. And I think that may be the way forward for Democrats in the past, in the South particularly, because the pie hasn't shown a whole lot of interest in moving.
I would argue that this growing the pie just is a fallacy. It's that it's not existing. I went back and I looked at the folks who voted in the 2018 Democratic primary, all these new voters, and they're not new to voting. They're just new to Democratic primaries. 93-94% of them voted in the 2016 general election, so they don't really add numbers to your vote total in November. They just play an outsized role in the Democratic primary.
Scott Holcomb, you want to respond to that?
Well, we'll see. I think an article that I read in the AJC, give a little shout out that I actually read the newspaper.
pay my bills.
89,000 new citizens in Atlanta just in 2017. So the state is definitely growing. It's continuing to grow. And I think that Abrams, who I've also endorsed, not high profile, but I have, she's a long-time friend, she is running a campaign that I think makes a lot of sense because other paths have been tried and she is trying something new. She is trying to energize voters. She is trying to engage in ways that haven't been done to the same extent that she is pursuing. And my takeaway on politics is that we know what works when it works. And so I don't think that you can just automatically discount what's happening. We're going to find out in November. And my sense is she's going to run a very compelling and close race.
I think that we've seen this tried before. In 2014 and in 2016, very high-profile efforts by Stacey Abrams with no appreciable difference in the votes.
But the difference is it wasn't her name on the ballot. In 2014.
I mean, you had Jason Carter and Michelle Nunn on the ballot in 14, and it didn't make an appreciable difference. I'm not sure that her being the leader of that movement makes an appreciable difference if you're using tools that just don't work.
Well, I mean, in 2014, we also had the top candidates running us, moderates to centrists on the Democratic side. In 16, Jim Barksdale did run much more to the left, but he also had very little campaign operations and didn't really have an effective message. We are seeing the makings of a lot more energy. We saw Democrats not outvote Republicans in the primary, but get closer to Republicans in terms of voting in the primary than we have seen in a decade or two.
But much of that was concentrated in areas like the 6th and the 7th districts where they haven't had a choice to vote for in years. If you live in the 7th district in Forsyth County or Gwinnett County, there has been not a thing to vote for in years in the Democratic primaries, except for the presidential primaries, but that's a completely different game. You can't vote for your sheriff. You can't vote for your county commissioners. You can't vote for your state House of Representatives members, your state senators, or congressmen if you in 2014, 2016, mm-hmm. 2012, 2010 in Forsyth County and Gwinnett County. And so the what's driving them partially has got to be that you have contested races for the first time.
Yeah.
And so these are not people who are just suddenly appearing as voters. These are people who have voted Democrat year in, year out in November. They just haven't voted in the primaries because there's been no choice for them.
And look, that's part of the Democratic overall strategy, I'd guess, right? I mean, there's dozens of state lawmakers who have been in safe Republican districts or seemingly safe Republican districts for years that have never had any challenger at all or never any credible challenger, and now they are, especially in the suburbs.
There are seats in areas like Gwinnett County where five commissioners oversee a multi-billion-dollar yearly budget that haven't been contested seriously in years that where you could have reached the tipping point. You've got boards of education. The Gwinnett County Board of Education has a Democrat on it, but it's a Democrat who served for 30-some years as a Republican and switched parties. But they haven't seriously contested a lot of those non-glamorous roles that give you seasoned candidates in the future years.
The foothold roles, yeah.
So I would agree. I think the Democrats have a weak bench at this point to put forward. But the question is going to be, are they going to be able to attract the imagination of a group of voters that are still not settled with one party or another? And that particularly reflects on folks that are moving into the state or younger voters that are coming into the system. I don't think they're settled necessarily as Democrats or Republicans. I think they have to be attracted by one side or the other.
I think, and I will say one thing that I think that the Georgia Democratic Party has done an outstanding job this year was recruiting. They contested a lot more races that they never even would have thought about, and that's a testament to a lot of hard work and a lot of smart work being done there. But if somebody moves into Georgia and they're 52 years old and the kind of income that makes people move for a job, they're not virginal nonpartisan entities. They have political leanings. They may be more Republican if they're from Ohio. They may be more Democratic if they're from New York. There are certainly stylistic differences between Georgia Republicans and, say, Massachusetts Republicans. Mm-hmm. But they don't come in as pure as snow with no partisan leanings. They just take – there's just a lag between when they start voting at the presidential level and when they start voting in the more local races.
I would completely agree with you, but one thing I would say is that as we're looking at folks that are moving into Georgia more recently, a lot of them have come from places like California, and a lot of them aren't 52 years old.
A lot of them are pretty young.
And a lot of them aren't white. And that has to do with some changes in the demographics of Georgia politics, possibly.
And at least two of those factors, generally speaking, make them even less likely to vote.
Yes.
And so you've got the newness to the state and those demographic factors that probably prolong the lag between their getting, you can move anywhere in the nation and know who you want to vote for president, but you don't know about the governor until you've lived there for 3 or 4 years. And so those demographic parts, the youth and such, probably extends that lag before they come online and start voting in the way that everybody expects them to vote.
And I'll throw out one last point. When you have a historic, unique candidate that's a first-in-the-nation candidate, that could change the dynamics in this particular race. You have an effect that isn't there in other races. I'm not predicting. I think Georgia's probably a red state. But it still makes for a very interesting election year here.
And that brings us back with Abrams. I mean, she was on NBC's Seth Meyers late-night show last night, and she was asked that very question. You know, why does she think her strategy focused on energizing liberal voters rather than trying to flip Donald Trump supporters is going to work? And she answered it with one word, math. In her view, mm-hmm. and we'll find out in November, but in her view, there is enough of an electorate there.
Well, the principles of mathematics haven't changed since this strategy failed in two consecutive cycles.
But I think the point that we're making is that it's a different – yes, you've got the math, but you also have different factors. It's a different candidate. We're just kind of in a different place as a country right now. I mean, those are the – you got the math, but then you've got these X factors as well.
And I think the choice that Greg suggests between – trying to flip Trump supporters and trying to energize liberals, that's a false dichotomy. I think that the real opportunity, and I think this was articulated very well by Stacey Evans, the real opportunity was disaffected Republicans, disaffected nonpartisan folks somewhere in the center who probably do make up a greater percentage of the electorate and are already voting.
Scott Holcomb, is Stacey Abrams going to try to make a play for those voters as well?
I don't think that it's going to be her core strategy. I think that most elections going forward are going to be about energizing your base. And most political scientists that I've read, Alan Abramowitz and others, is they would disagree with what Todd just said in terms of this mysterious big center. The center is shrinking, and people know exactly how they view the world, and then they align themselves accordingly. That said, Todd is right. in terms of some disaffected Republicans. And we see that drumbeat a lot. And there are a number, both nationally and otherwise, that really don't feel like their values are being represented by the current administration. And I'll also say, because it's been mentioned a couple times about the last two cycles, the 18 cycle is a completely different cycle from what happened in 16 and certainly 14. 14 was a wave year for Republicans. I don't know any expert or non-expert who is expecting this to be a Republican wave year. I think everybody is more on the other side that this is likely to be a very successful year for Democratic candidates, both nationally and I think here in Georgia.
Okay, I want to bring this part of the discussion to a close, but just I want to note a couple of other results from last night. Ben Jealous, the former president of the NAACP, won the Democratic primary, won the Democratic nomination for governor in Maryland. Yeah. He's an ally of Stacey Abrams. Also, Mitt Romney. Gosh, I can't believe we're talking about Mitt Romney, but he's going to be the GOP nominee for U.S. Senate in Utah.
And odds are, next senator too. I mean, yeah, that he has probably a 98% chance of winning that race.
Yep.
I wanted to talk about something that Representative Holcomb said. He was talking about Professor Abramowitz at Emory. I was a student in the political science department at Emory 25 years ago this year, and at that time he was one of the gray eminences of political science. My fear is that I think his partisanship has affected his political judgment in the last 3 to 5 years. He has come out as a strong advocate for liberal causes and liberal politicians in a way that is not consistent with.
But does that affect his work as a political scientist, though?
It's one thing to have
personal opinions, but it's another thing if you're an academic and this is your field to say that has an effect on your work.
It absolutely does, because the most respected political scientist in that department, Merle Black, stayed so far removed from politics that he never even voted, because he thought that would be either a conflict of interest or it would give some indication as to his partisan leanings. You can have no question about Dr. Abramowitz's partisan leanings. He is still a brilliant political scientist, but it appears to me that sometimes he is trying to make a partisan point more than he is trying to simply present pure research.
Well, I don't agree with that.
I think we would need to, I would like to have Dr. Abramowitz on to respond to that, but he's not here. So let's move on. Let's talk about some Republican Party infighting. Greg, the AJC reported earlier this week on Governor Deal and House Speaker David Ralston. They're campaigning against State Representative Matt Gertler. What's going on there?
Yeah, this was one of the more interesting races. We were just talking about Democratic state legislators that had really close fights. Well, this is a Republican state lawmaker who was known as the biggest no voter in the state legislature. Scott, you sat right near him. He voted no. I don't know.
He voted against Republican.
Voted against Republican, Democrat, whatever it is. Right. He voted no.
On
just about every bill that came before him, a lot of bills, and really provoked the ire of Republican leaders in that North Georgia district he represents. Both Governor Deal and House Speaker David Ralston campaigned directly against him for his opponent, who ended up getting defeated pretty handily. So it showed that, in some areas, the anti-establishment streak, and I guess he is very anti-establishment because he votes against everything, is very strong, especially up in the North Georgia mountains where, the voters are known for being fiercely independent and fiercely conservative.
I think that's a really good point, and I think there is a restlessness in the electorate in general that wants to thumb their noses up and say, we don't like business as usual. What I would say as a political scientist and thinking about what that might mean in governance is if you elect a lot of people that really don't want to make compromises and come to conclusion, you don't get a lot of things passed, and that can be a problem for governance.
I think there was a geographic effect there, too. There are other members of the Republican Party who probably annoy leadership just as much as Representative Gertler did. But the fact that he's right up there in the mountains between Gainesville and Blue Ridge probably had something to do with it.
I think it's safe to say he annoyed them more than anyone else.
Just for context here, we should say Speaker Ralston, he represents Blue Ridge, yep. And Governor Deal is from that corner of the state as well.
But There is a part of the Republican Party that wants to thumb their nose at the establishment. It's the folks who show up at DeKalb County Republican Party breakfasts and Gwinnett County breakfasts and this thing on the 4th of July that the DeKalb County Party is having. But there's also a large part of the Republican electorate, the business wing, that's really happy with everything that's going on. And one of the things that I was kind of surprised to see was there were some areas that Republican primary voting was suppressed or lower than it should have been. And I think part of that is actually a complacency, a happiness that things sort of, from their perspective, seem to be going on track in a way that they haven't ever been before. And so they don't have the anger to motivate them to the polls.
And overall, I think that if you want to call it the establishment of the GOP in Georgia has been pretty successful in terms of getting rid of members of the General Assembly that they don't want. There were some unsuccessful candidates in primaries this year who I think the establishment is happy not to have back. In terms of Representative Gertler, I like him. We get along really well. And one of the interesting things about the General Assembly is those who are some of the most conservative members are really good on transparency, and we've worked together on a number of issues, and I think it's probably unlikely that he'll be targeted again because he was successful in holding on, and so they'll just have to figure out a way to deal with him.
There is a bit of a dichotomy there, though, because there are blocks of both parties that don't want compromise. And yet we saw, especially this year, a tremendous amount of compromise in the Georgia legislature. And I think that was capped just last week with the announcement of $100 million for a bus rapid transit along Georgia 400 up in North Metro Atlanta, the first really big direct investment from the state in mass transit.
Well, and I think you get into the frustration level and the politics of frustration when you elect a lot of folks, again, without experience, that may want to hold to very ideological positions. And this happens on both sides of the political spectrum. You don't get a lot of centrist kind of compromise policy, the pro-business kind of Republicans that we've kind of expected with Nathan Deal and Sonny Perdue before him. I mean, they come in a consistent kind of centrist perspective of governance. And one of the questions about it is the best way to get government to elect people to it. I like it better than any other way, but it's got its problems.
Better than all the others.
Yes.
And I think the case of Senator Josh McCoon is gives you an idea of the limits of being the most popular guy in the anti-establishment mm-hmm. wing of the Republican Party. Came in third, I guess, mm-hmm. in his Secretary of State's race against two folks who, are relatively business friendly.
And much lower profiles.
Yep.
All right, we're going to get another break out of the way here on Political Rewind. We'll come back. We've got lots more to talk about. We hope you'll stay with us.
On the next Fresh Air, W. Kamau Bell returns. He has a new Netflix stand-up comedy special called Private School Negro. His CNN series, United Shades of America, is in its third season. And he has a new web miniseries about investigating his ancestry and turning up some big surprises, including one about his white great-great-grandfather. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Thanks for listening to Political Rewind on GPB or watching us. We've got our live stream up at the GPB News Facebook page. We're talking today with Democratic State Representative Scott Holcomb, Republican strategist Todd Rehm, Mercer University's Chris Grant, and Greg Bluestein from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Let's talk about trade and tariffs. David Perdue, or Sonny Perdue, rather, says that Trump has authorized him to protect farmers from some of the economic harm that could be caused by the trade fights that the Trump administration has started. And Perdue says he hopes to have a plan in place by the time farmers begin their fall harvest if no resolution has been reached. Secretary Perdue said, "We will not allow agriculture producers to bear the brunt of China's retaliation as we defend our own interests as a nation." But Greg, a lot of agricultural products from Georgia end up in China.
Yeah, I mean, this cuts to the heart of the issue, is that a lot of the same base of supporters that voted for Donald Trump and other Republicans would be the most hurt by some of these tariffs that could be levied on their products. And you saw the Harley-Davidson news earlier this week. You have news of tariffs, threatened tariffs up and down the industries. So there's a lot of concern for voters who might not see the parallels between what's happening in Washington and what's happening with their products. You know, it's certainly a sort of a specter out there that the very same voters who back those policies could end up being hurt by them.
Todd.
One of the things that I think is becoming clear in Georgia is that South Georgia and the agricultural areas have a different relationship to the federal government and to ideology than the suburban core of which is really the dominant wing of the Republican Party. When it comes to things like farm bills, that's the kind of thing that if you're a South Georgia congressman, you have to vote right on the farm bill. You have to work to get your folks protected under the farm bill. But when you're up for a statewide election, it's something that you'll be pilloried for because you voted for, you know, expanding food stamps and pork and all this other stuff and for greater government intervention in the economy. And this is not an issue that is going to hurt a lot of Republicans in Gwinnett County, in Forsyth County, in Walton County, in Cherokee County. But it's going to hurt a lot of Republicans in South Georgia. But what I would say is one of the critiques folks have of President Trump is that his ideas don't stick with him very long. He'll be distracted by one thing and then he'll be on one tangent and he'll go at it hard for 72 hours and he'll go in a different direction. And what we have seen, some of the more effective cabinet members, some of the more effective other leaders within the federal government have found a way to work with that. And they sort of latch on to what he says that they like and move forward with that. And if he says something that they don't like, they just sort of wait around, see if it blows over. And if it does, they go back to what they were pushing. That's how Mike Pence has done a great deal of cutting regulations in Congress without necessarily being visible. And I don't get the sense that he has taken each one of those things to the president to check on. So it's one of those areas that I'm not sure this is going to be a long-lasting policy, and we may have former Governor Perdue trying to find a middle path that helps the farmers.
In trying to do, I mean, my point, the question I was about to ask you, it seems that Sonny Perdue may be one of those folks in the administration who kind of has that, who's been able to develop that relationship with Trump where he kind of acknowledges the thing that he's interested in, but also tries to find if there's harm by it, to try to find a way to work through it.
Yeah, and I think having his cousin being on the good side of the president is helpful. I was reading something. I started Googling on Mitt Romney in Senate last night, and I read this interesting article where a close Romney advisor was saying that what Romney seems to have done, and what a lot of other folks seem to have done, is to just ignore the tweets and all that stuff and concentrate on the policy. And most Republicans are pretty happy with most of the concrete policy that's actually been enacted. Tax cuts, the way the economy is going today, they're very happy with that. And they're just learning to tune out some of the noise that they may or may not care for.
You mentioned the farm. Sorry, Chris, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, as I would add, I think that Governor Perdue, Secretary Perdue, comes at it from the perspective of a farmer, and farmers are pretty insightful in being able to separate out state and federal policy and what happens in those things. I don't think we're going to suddenly see a big switch of our rural white Georgia farmers going to the Democratic Party over this issue. I think they respect Sonny Perdue and what he can do for them, and I think they are sophisticated thinkers, actually, about politics and have been for a long time.
I was just going to say, Todd Ream mentioned the farm bill. Farm bill is making it was passed the House. It's in the Senate right now. David Perdue put out a press release earlier this week. He kind of went point by point with quotes from the agriculture or from the Peanut Commission and all the different vegetable and agriculture lobby groups that there are that would see an impact from the farm bill. It also included a quote from the president of Fort Valley State University that is one of these, they're called the 1890 land grant schools. These are historically black colleges that were set up in 1890 to train African-American farmers and agronomists and whatnot. And we played some tape on the show a couple of weeks ago, a speech that Congressman David Scott gave on the House floor that was castigating Republicans for removing some things that would benefit these 1890 schools like Fort Valley State in Middle Georgia. Well, here's this quote from the president of Fort Valley State saying that David Perdue worked to get those aspects of the farm bill back into the bill itself, and that's what the Senate's going to vote on this week.
And I think it's interesting that David Perdue is, in terms of the way he thinks and works, he seems to be the exact opposite of President Trump. David Perdue has been single-mindedly focused on the deficit and on the trade imbalance and on inversion, corporate inversions, and on several very kind of wonky technical things. And there have been times when he has said that, you know, President Trump shares my commitment to X, Y, and Z, and I sort of just look at him like I'd never heard that. I'm not sure. You know, maybe that was a private conversation or something, but but it's really interesting to see how he just has this laser focus on economics that I think we'll come to appreciate.
So moving on, the other thing that's happening this afternoon, Johnny Isaacson, Georgia's other senator, he chairs the VA committee in the Senate, and they're holding hearings this afternoon on the new nominee for VA Secretary Robert Wilkie. And this follows a report in The Washington Post that includes some details of Wilkie's past, including reportedly working with the Sons of Confederate Veterans and for former North Carolina Republican Senator Jesse Helms. So that hearing, though, is happening this afternoon. VA, though, that's been an issue where President Trump had one VA secretary, you had a nominee for another, and now we're on another, Greg.
Yeah, and from what I understand, though, both Democrats and Republicans on that committee, including Senator Isaacson, don't expect the allegations that were revealed in that profile of the nominee Robert Wilkie to be an issue. But this is certainly something that the Trump administration wants to shore up and get behind them because there was such a controversy over the last nomination.
Sorry about that. I just sorry. I lost my place on my notes here. So let's talk a little bit about family reunifications. A U.S. district judge has granted an injunction to the ACLU over the group's lawsuit challenging the policy. But still, Scott Holcomb, there's still a lot of children who are disconnected from their families, and it's kind of a difficult situation that the Trump administration now has to deal with.
That's correct. And I mean, candidly, it's a mess. And I don't have any faith or confidence that they really have an understanding of exactly how bad the problem is or how to solve it. And that's actually true through a lot of these issues that we talked about, tariffs, et cetera, is they go forward without much care or forethought, and then they deal with the consequences afterwards. But it is very significant and very serious. And we need to take action a lot more rapidly, and I think that you're going to continue to see a lot of activism focused on this until the problem's solved. And it really is, a bipartisan support for getting this fixed in a hurry. Get the kids back.
I just wonder what the fix is, though, because there are so many children who've been removed from their families, and they don't have contact information for the parents and getting people back together. Todd Ream, what do you see as the path out of this for the Trump administration, or the path going forward?
This is not an area I'm comfortable talking about.
Okay,
and no matter what, it won't be an easy fix. But both parties are calling for some sort of comprehensive overhaul of immigration. Yet Democrats also wanted a more narrowly tailored fix just about involving this issue before Trump reversed his executive order. But, you know, we're going to hear it all through November because Democrats are hoping to energize their voters based on this failed policy and this reverse policy, I should say. And Republicans are going to say right back at them that there needs to be some sort of comprehensive solution and that Republicans want to have some sort of answer on the table on that.
Well, Republicans, they had two bills and neither one of them could get through.
Yeah.
And they control the levers in Congress right now.
Yep. So go for it.
Go ahead.
All I was going to say is I think it's a very animating issue for the Democrats. I think it's a very frustrating issue for the Republicans. The optics of it have some devastating effects for Republican candidates in tight races.
They do, and we've seen them play in the 6th District here in Georgia, in the 7th District. We've seen them even play in the governor's race with both Secretary of State Brian Kemp and Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle defending Trump's policies on immigration and demanding more border security, and even saying that they'd send Georgia National Guard troops to protect the U.S. border with Mexico, while at the same time, Stacey Abrams says that's a failed policy and that the state needs to be more tolerant and open and accepting of immigrants, period.
It could go either way in the end. It could animate voters on either side, or maybe it'll animate voters on both sides, in ways that we haven't expected.
Oh, I think it absolutely would animate voters on both sides.
It will.
Yeah.
Politically speaking, it may be a win-win.
It could be.
So coming up later this week, we'll have another edition of Political Rewind. As I said, Bill Nugget will be back with us next week. But also, we're coming up to July 1st, the middle part of the year. That's also when a lot of new laws take effect, Greg Bluestein. The one that we've been hearing about the most is the hands-free law related to distracted driving and cell phones while you're driving. Greg, what else changes July 1st?
I mean, that's the big headliner, is the distracted driving, because it really will usher in a cultural change among drivers in Georgia. It's also the year-old anniversary of the campus carry legislation, so we're going to have a little bit more on that next week. But as in terms of headlining laws, that's the big one, distracted driving.
There was also something Attorney General Chris Carr put out a press release yesterday about credit freezes, something going to affect with that, and which I should probably not bring up without being prepared to ask you about it, because you're looking at me and you, Greg, you don't look like you know what I'm talking about here.
I think there's legislation that makes it easier for Georgians to get their credit frozen and thawed and unthawed and unfrozen. And there's also legislation that makes it easier for authorities to track opioid abuse and to crack down on opioid abuse. I think the medical marijuana expansion of the medical marijuana provisions to include patients with PTSD goes into effect on July 1st. So there's a sweep of legislation, but I think the bill that's going to affect most of us the most, is the distracted driving one.
Yeah, and if I can, I'd also add that one measure that I was very involved with this year will go into effect, and it is to let victims of domestic violence break their leases without early termination penalty, because that economic barrier kept some people in bad situations, and so we were able to get legislation passed to address that this year.
All right, that's Democratic State Representative Scott Holcomb, also joining us this afternoon, Republican strategist Todd Rehm, Greg Bluestein from the AJC, and Mercer University Political Science Chair Chris Grant. Gentlemen, thanks to all of you.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
Thank you for listening to Political Rewind. Fresh Air coming up next at 3 o'clock, and we'll be back with you on Friday.